The only one that Netanyahu addressed today in his speech. You're usually in Ramallah. You spend a lot of time on the West Bank. Where does this leave the Palestinian Authority? I don't think the West Bank is talked about in this deal. And what about the fact that we're looking at pictures of Netanyahu surrounded by Steve Witkoff on one side and Jared Kushner, who has talked about, as we know, famously referred to Gaza as very valuable waterfront property?
Well, I think that this plan was really an Israeli plan, and it was repackaged and branded as a Trump plan. And you can see just in the text of it and the way that all of the guarantees were given to the Israelis and none given to the Palestinians, it's really an Israeli plan. But beyond that, it's important to keep in mind that when Trump was going around and talking about this plan, that he consulted with everybody but Palestinians. He didn't talk to Mahmoud Abbas. He didn't even let Mahmoud Abbas go to the UN to deliver his speech before the UN. I'm pretty certain he didn't speak to the UN representative, the Palestinians representative to the UN. And so this is, once again, we've got a plan in which people are talking about Palestinians, but never talking to Palestinians. So again, this is very much an Israeli plan repackaged as a Trump plan and branded as a Trump plan. In terms of them looking at Gaza as being prime real estate, this is not at all different from the way that they've done it in the past. And this is not at all the way that Israel has looked at Palestine. And this is because this is the way that colonizers look at land that isn't theirs. They ignore the history of the place. Gaza has an old history. It has some of the oldest churches, I think the second oldest church in the world. It has some of the oldest mosques. It has an old civilization. We want Gaza to be Gaza. We don't want it to be Dubai or any other place. We want it to be Gaza. And so the idea of somehow turning it into prime real estate, this is the mentality of somebody who's coming from outside. This is the way that colonizers think. This isn't the way that the indigenous think. And so you can see in this plan that it's not only the idea of the outside coming in, but they certainly didn't consult Palestinians at all. As for what's going to happen to the Palestinian Authority, it's clear that they don't want the Palestinian Authority in the Gaza Strip. And it's clear that they do want to have a foreign authority in the Gaza Strip. But once again, Amy, when is it that Palestinians get to decide our own future? Are we really going back to the era of colonialism when other people get to decide our future? And that's what this plan is really all about.
Well, we're going to be continuing to cover the story. President Trump is expected to be there for the signing of the ceasefire in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt on Sunday. And the hostages and prisoners are expected to be released on Monday or Tuesday. Diana Bhutu, I want to thank you for being with us, Palestinian human rights attorney, former advisor to the negotiating team of the Palestine Liberation Organization. And Amjad Araki, Israel-Palestine analyst at the International Crisis Group. When we come back, the Nobel Committee recognizes a leading U.S.-backed Venezuelan opposition leader. The announcement coming as Venezuela is facing mounting threats from the Trump administration, which has repeatedly bombed boats off the coast of Venezuela. We'll speak with the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Greg Grandin. Stay with us. Tunisian-American artist Emel Mefluthi performing Kelty Hora, My Word is Free, at the 2015 Nobel Peace Prize concert in Oslo. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. The Norwegian Nobel Committee announced today the recipient of the 2025 Nobel Peace Prize.
The Nobel Peace Prize for 2025 goes to a brave and committed champion of peace, to a woman who keeps the flame of democracy burning amidst a growing darkness. The Norwegian Nobel Committee has decided to award the Nobel Peace Prize for 2025 to Maria Corina Machado. She is receiving the Nobel Peace Prize for her tireless work promoting democratic rights for the people of Venezuela and for her struggle to achieve a just and peaceful transition from dictatorship to democracy. Maria Corina Machado meets all the three criteria stated in Alfred Nobel's will for the selection of a peace prize. She has brought her country's opposition together. She has never wavered in resisting the militarization of Venezuelan society. She has been steadfast in her support for a peaceful transition to democracy.
Maria Corina Machado is a longtime U.S. ally nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize last year by a number of Florida Republicans, including then-Senator Marco Rubio, who's now President Trump's Secretary of State. In 2002, Machado supported the coup that briefly overthrew Venezuela's democratically elected president, Hugo Chavez. Machado attempted to run for president against incumbent Nicolas Maduro in the 2024 race, but was barred from running after the government accused her of corruption and cited her support for U.S. sanctions against Venezuela. Edmundo Gonzalez ran in her place. Venezuela's National Electoral Council declared Maduro the winner, but the opposition claimed Gonzalez won. Machado has vowed to privatize Venezuela's state oil industry. She's also praised right-wing Latin American leaders, including Argentina's Javier Milei. The Nobel Committee's selection of Machado comes at a time of heightened tension between the U.S. and Venezuela, as the U.S. continually bombs boats off the coast of Venezuela while threatening to launch a larger military operation. On Thursday, the Venezuelan government requested an emergency session of the U.N. Security Council to discuss the U.S. military actions. For more, we go to Greg Grandin, Yale University history professor, Pulitzer Prize-winning author, whose latest book is America, America, A New History of the New World. Professor Grandin, welcome back to Democracy Now! Your response to this Nobel Prize announcement.
Well, thanks for having me, Amy. It's a perplexing choice on a number of levels, and it seems inevitably will bring about the opposite of peace. Machado is not a unifier, as the committee said. She represents the most intransigent face of the opposition, and not just, as you mentioned in your introduction, not just against Maduro, but against democratically elected Hugo Chavez. She was a supporter of the 2002 coup. She has constantly divided the opposition and handicapped the opposition, frankly, when the opposition was trying to come up with a more moderate position that could challenge the socialism of 21st century socialism that Chavez represented. She constantly represented a more hard line in terms of economics, in terms of U.S. relations. And that intransigence has led her to rely on outside powers, notably the United States. So, I mean, they didn't give it to Donald Trump, but they seem to have given it to the next best thing in terms of, at least as far as Marco Rubio is concerned, if he needs justification to escalate military operations against Venezuela, it really seems to be a disastrous choice and a smear on the I mean, your next guest is Cory Doctorow. It's really the institution of the Nobel Peace Prize. I mean, they gave it to Kissinger in the 1970s, but at least they waited till he negotiated an end to the Vietnam War. I mean, I think of Rigoberta Menchú, who won it in the early 1980s, and her whole family was wiped out by U.S.-supported militarists and death squads in Guatemala, and now they've given it to somebody who's completely aligned with the most militarist and darkest face of U.S. imperialism. It's really a shocking choice.
And very quickly, again, this coming as the U.S. bombs one Venezuelan boat after another. The Colombian president, Petro, said in one of the bombings, a Colombian was killed. But an interesting piece in the New York Times, President Trump calling off efforts to reach a diplomatic agreement with Venezuela, paving the way for potential military escalation. Richard Grenell, the special presidential envoy, interim executive director of the Kennedy Center, had been leading the negotiations with Maduro. He has been instructed to cut off all diplomatic outreach. So as we wrap up, if you can talk about what is happening right now and the rage President Trump, interestingly, will feel at not getting the Nobel Peace Prize himself, as he has very explicitly demanded, and escalating what's going on in Venezuela.
Yeah, it's just going to harden positions all around. And Machado has not denounced. She's actually endorsed the general framework for that legitimates the bombing of these go fast boats in the Caribbean. Four of them now. Last one filled apparently with Colombians. She hasn't denounced it. She's supported it. She supports the idea, the framework that the government is basically a cartel, and to blow up these boats is not to kill Venezuelans, but to kill, as she puts it, narcotraficantes. I mean, it's really, there are plenty of feminist activists that oppose Maduro in Venezuela that would have legitimated the Peace Prize, that would have legitimated the opposition. There's Isabel Mejías, who's a feminist. She's the head of Araña Feminista, the feminist spider. There's Ana Rosa Torres, who considers herself a socialist, that she opposes the opposition and U.S. policy. That would have made sense if the committee felt that, it was time for Maduro to go. But this really just actually strengthens Maduro, because it confirms his narrative about the opposition being in league with the Trump administration. So you could just imagine that this is going to, as I said, bring about the opposite of peace. It's laying the groundwork and justifying greater military escalation. It's really a disaster. It's really, really hard to understand how they came to this decision.
Greg Grandin, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Yale University history professor, Pulitzer Prize-winning author, his latest book, America America, A New History of the New World. Next up, we speak with the acclaimed writer Cory Doctorow, author of a new book, and what should we say? And Bleepification, Why Everything Suddenly Got Worse and What to Do About It. Stay with us.
Yesterday I saw you standing there with your hand against the pane, looking out the window at the rain, and I wanted to tell
Kingdom by Patti Smith, performing at our Democracy Now! 20th anniversary. Next year, we celebrate our 30th. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show with the acclaimed writer and tech activist Cory Doctorow. 3 years ago, he coined a term to describe how online platforms like Facebook degrade over time as platform owners seek to maximize profit. The phrase Doctorow came up with went viral. But due to FCC rules, we can't say it on the air. We'll just call it an bleepification. The bleep is covering a word that rhymes with hit. It's also the title of Cory Doctorow's new book. Cory, welcome to Democracy Now!, the book title and bleepification, why everything suddenly got worse and what to do about it. Why don't you start from the beginning? What do you mean by this term?
So it's a way to talk about how the platforms go bad, but it's also a way to talk about why the platforms go bad. So we can see this characteristic pattern of decay in platforms, where first they're good to their end users. They find a way to lock those users in. And once it's hard for the users to leave, they can make things worse for those end users to tempt in business customers. Those business customers also get locked to the platform. And so then things are made bad for them, too, because they can't readily depart. And eventually you end up with a platform where all the value has been harvested by shareholders and executives. And there's just kind of a mingy homeopathic residue of value left behind for the platform users. And yet, because of these broader factors that are about the social critique, the political and economic critique, it's hard for us to leave these platforms. And they sort of shamble on.
So tell us how it works. Take one example, whether you're talking about Google, whether you're talking about Twitter, whether you're talking about Facebook, and talk about how they started and where they're headed.
I think Facebook's the canonical case, right? So Mark Zuckerberg, 2006, wants to open up beyond American college kids. You don't need a .edu address anymore. So he says, come to Facebook. We're the platform that, unlike MySpace, will never spy on you. And we're only going to show you the things that you ask to see. So if you subscribe to some people, that's what's going to be in your feed. And so people pile in and they lock themselves into through something called the collective action problem, which is just a way of saying, you know, you love your friends, but they're a pain in the butt. And even though you all want to hang out and play a board game this weekend, you can't agree on what board game to play, much less even though you all agree that you hate Facebook, you can't agree on when it's time to leave or where to go, or how to reestablish yourself. So you get stuck there. And once you're stuck there, Mark Zuckerberg starts to make things worse for you to make things better for business customers. So they go to the advertisers and they say, hey, you remember we told these rubes we weren't going to spy on them? Total lie. We spy on them with every hour that God sends. Give us small dollars. We will target ads to those people with just incredible fidelity, and we'll spend as much money as it takes to stop ad fraud. So you give us a dollar to show an ad to a user, that user's going to see that ad. And publishers get a similar deal. You know, we told these users we wouldn't stick stuff in their feed they didn't ask to see, but we'll make an exception for you. Put stuff on Facebook from your website, little excerpts, link back to your own website. We'll just cram it into the eyeballs of people who never asked to see it. Some of them will click the link. You'll get to monetize that traffic. And so they become locked in too. They become dependent on those users who are dependent on each other. And now ad prices go up. Ad targeting fidelity goes down, ad fraud explodes. Procter & Gamble used to spend $200 million a year on surveillance ads. In 2017, they took that to zero and saw a $0 drop in sales because all those ads were just disappearing down the fraud hole. Meanwhile, publishers are finding they have to put more and more of their content onto Facebook in order to just be shown to their own subscribers. So they have to substitute for their own website. And even, you know, you put a link in the bottom of your page, they're not even going to show that to anyone because maybe the link's a malicious link. So now you have all the value harvested for Facebook. And they're in this very brittle equilibrium because the difference between I hate this place, but I can't stop coming to it, and I hate this place, I'm not coming back, it's very brittle. You take one scandal, one live stream mass shooting, people bolt for the exits, and then Facebook panics. And being tech bros, they call it pivoting. And so one day, you know, Mark Zuckerberg arises from his sarcophagus, and he says, you know, hearken to me, brothers and sisters, for I've had a vision. I know I told you that the future would consist of arguing with your racist uncle using this primitive text interface I made in my dorm room to non-consensually rate the bangability of my fellow undergraduates, but actually, I'm going to transform you and everyone you love into a legless, sexless, low-polygon, heavily surveilled cartoon character, so I can imprison you in a virtual world I stole from a 25-year-old satirical cyberpunk novel that I call the metaverse, right? And that is the final stage of in bleepification. The platform is a giant pile of bleep.
So let's go to what you wrote about President Trump and the platform owners. In the United States, you write, at the 2025 inauguration, Trump spoke from within a decorative semicircle of tech billionaires, Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg, former Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos, Google CEO Sundar Pichai, Apple CEO Tim Cook, TikTok CEO Shoji Chu, and of course, Elon Musk. These men intervened in many ways on Trump's behalf. So if you can talk about President Trump, his circle of platform owners, you talk about Donald Trump's election representing the ultimate triumph of imbleepification of the political realm.
So, you know, this is a theory about not just why the platforms are bad now, but you have to interrogate why they were better before. What stopped them from going bad? Because we didn't invent greed in like 2017. So what was it that stopped them from going bad? My theory is they had constraints. They had to worry about competitors, but then we let them buy all their competitors. They had to worry about regulators, but when you boil a company down to, or an industry down to like five giant websites filled with screenshots of text from the other four, they have so much profits from not competing, and they find it so easy to agree that they capture regulators. They also had to worry about their workers, because tech workers have been so powerful. Even though they weren't unionized, they were in enormous demand, super productive. Then there's a National Bureau of Economic Research paper that estimates that the average Silicon Valley worker was contributing $1 million a year to the bottom line of their employer. So their employers really valued them. They couldn't afford to lose them. They couldn't replace them. And you take all that away, and you get an environment in which people can do bad things with impunity. They don't face any consequences. And Trump, that was his promise. I'll neuter the National Labor Relations Board. I'll get rid of antitrust unless you make me angry, in which case I'll do antitrust until you use the Trump coin tip jar on the Resolute desk to give me some money. And I'm going to let you buy as many of your competitors as you want and not have to worry about any of these external sources of discipline. And, you know, even the best of us without discipline go horribly wrong. You know, this is the problem of people who can just shout at other people. We all have writers we love who eventually get so big they can tell their editors to go to hell, and then their books get really terrible. But, you know, Howard Hughes, if you gave him some constraints, would make you some pretty cool airplanes. Take away the constraints, that guy starts wearing Kleenex boxes on his feet and saving his urine in jars, right? So what these platforms aspire to is their own demise, right? It's what Trump aspires to be in a world in which no one can tell him no, and in which every bad idea that kind of materializes in the vacant spaces in his head becomes a policy. And so, you know, poopification is the collapse of discipline, and America's ruling class has managed to neutralize all the discipline that it ever faced. Their weirdest, worst ideas are the ones that we're all stuck with.
What do you think of the Trump deal that would put his billionaire ally, Larry Ellison, who became the richest man in the world for a few weeks ago, in charge of TikTok?
I think it shows you that the origin of this phenomenon is not users making bad consumption decisions. It's not executives being greedy. It's a policy environment that's like in bleepogenic, right? That when you have an environment that says you can do bad things and you can get away with it, then it doesn't really matter who's running the companies, right? Like, we can say, oh, you know, Larry Ellison might be worse than the guy no one's ever heard of who runs TikTok. But is he really going to be worse than it? I mean, TikTok thumbed the scales for right-wing candidates in the last election cycle. And they were able to do that because they operate in total opacity. We have laws like the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. This is a Bill Clinton law from 1998. Section 12.1 of that law makes it a felony. Like, you go to jail for 5 years and pay a $500,000 fine for reverse engineering stuff to modify it. So if you wanted to put a different algorithm in your TikTok client or just stop it from stealing your data while you use it, that's a crime, right? And so, you know, we could have said, rather than we are going to replace one guy who fills a, you know, tech supervillain-shaped hole with another guy who fills a tech villain-shaped hole in TikTok C-suite, we could have said we're going to empower people, co-ops, nonprofits, startups, even big commercial rivals, to reverse engineer the TikTok app, to change how the algorithm works for you so that you see the things that you want to see, so that it becomes a platform that's responsive to you. And just as when we made it legal to block ads on the web, it's not legal on apps because you have to reverse engineer them. we instilled discipline in companies who had to worry that if you made the ads too obnoxious on their website, you'd go install an ad blocker. 51% of web users have installed an ad blocker. It's the biggest consumer boycott in human history. And so they have to think twice before they make it worse. When you take away that discipline, when you say, okay, well, you can do whatever you want and no one is, it can defend themselves. You have the full panoply of all the things you can do with digital tools, where you can change the rules from moment to moment. You can change the recommendation system. You can, at your whim, alter the game. I call it the Darth Vader MBA. I'm altering the deal. Pray don't alter it further. And we're defenseless in front of it. You get the worst of all technological worlds, a world where technology torments you endlessly and never saves you from that torment.
Talk about Google. How it started and where it is now and what it's taking from. I mean, it's not only hurting consumers, it's not only hurting people trying to communicate, but businesses as well.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, Google is a company that has had one really good idea. It was in the last millennium. They made a really good search engine. Virtually everything they made in-house since has crashed and burned. Almost everything they make is a company they bought from someone else in violation of antitrust law and waivers that were mergers, rather, that were waived through under both Republicans and Democrats. And they pretend they're, you know, Willy Wonka's Idea Factory. They're just like rich Uncle Pennybags buying other kids' toys, right? And they eventually became not just too big to fail, they became too big to care. In 2019, as we found out in the DOJ's lawsuit against Google last year, they, having acquired a 90% search market share, stalled out on growth. Obviously, right? How are you going to grow your search when you've got a 90% market share? We're already all using it, and we're already using it for everything. I mean, yes, they could breed a billion humans to maturity and make them Google customers. They called that product Google Classroom, but it takes a minute to mature. And meanwhile, they want growth now because investors want growth now. So in the memos that the DOJ published, we see this epic battle play out for the soul of Google. You have these two characters. One's this guy, Prabhakar Raghavan. It's this ex-McKinsey guy, came from Yahoo. He's in charge of search revenue. And he has this idea. What if we make the search worse? What if we turn off all the stuff that tries to guess the best match for your query so that when you search, you don't get the best match, you have to search again and maybe again and maybe again each time we get to show you more ads, right? That's growth. Now, he's opposed by this guy called Ben Gomes, who's, you know, kind of the epitome of an OG Googler. He is the guy who built out their server infrastructure. He started with one server under a desk at Stanford, built the global network of data centers, and now he's in charge of search technology. And in the memos, you can see Gomes is palpably horrified by this idea to make this thing that he's worked so hard for worse, just for this venal purpose. And then they have this fight. And the fight plays out in the memos. And basically, Prabhakar Raghavan and his allies' argument is, I don't really care if this makes you feel icky, because it's going to make us more money and we will face no consequences. Now, it's not just that Google was shorn of the consequences of making their product worse. They also used to have to really value their workers. But because the workers thought of themselves as temporarily embarrassed entrepreneurs and thought, well, we're being treated really well now, why do we need a union? As soon as supply caught up with demand and you got 500,000 tech layoffs in the last 3 years, the workers lost the power to discipline them too.
So in this last minute that we're going to do a part two,
sure.
Is there a breaking point beyond which even locked-in users rebel against these tech platforms?
Yeah.
Where do you see the fight back?
So there is a breaking point. I don't think we want to reach it, right? There's a breaking point where people who live in the urban wildlife interface are like, oh, my house keeps burning down every year. I guess I'm going to leave now that everything I own has been destroyed. Ideally, you'd want those people to leave beforehand. So people are on these platforms because the platforms do good things for them. People are on Facebook because it's where the people with the same rare disease as them meet, or it's where the people in the country they emigrated away from meet, or it's where their affinity group meets. And we don't want those things to be destroyed by a forced departure. We want to evacuate the platforms. And I think that in the European Union, there's this effort underway to create like portability. So if you leave Facebook or Twitter, you might be able to go to another platform. Maybe that's Blue Sky, maybe it's Mastodon, maybe it's something that hasn't been invented yet, and still stay in touch with the people you left behind. So you don't have to choose between the people you love and the platform you hate.
So we're going to talk about Blue Sky, Mastodon, and much more in part two. But right now, we have to wrap up the show. Cory Doctorow is a science fiction author, activist, journalist. He works for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. His new book is, okay, well, we'll say and bleepification why everything suddenly got worse and what to do about it. That does it for our show. I'll be on the road on October 17th. I'll be in Santa Fe at the Santa Fe Film Festival, where the new film Steal the Story, Please is going to be playing. And I'll be doing the Q&A after. On October 18th, I'll be in Woodstock 19th, Saugerties. I'm Amy Goodman. Check our website, democracynow.org.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain.
Do you know what your local wetland has done for you lately? Wetlands function like nature's kidneys, mitigating the impacts of floods and droughts, protecting our communities, and supporting food production. Despite representing 6% of the Earth's surface, wetlands store 33% of the planet's carbon. If you value life, thank a wetland. Learn about wetlands at work with Ducks Unlimited Canada at ducks.ca/wetlands.